Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, you may press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting over to your host for today's conference, Mr. Howard Wachler. Sir, you may begin.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Howard Wachler, Division Director for Information and Intelligence Systems in the SIES Directorate. This morning, it is a great pleasure for me to be able to introduce my longtime friend and colleague, Daniel Sawarek, to come speak to us. Dan is the Buell University Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering and Computer Science at Carnegie Mellon University. Despite how he looks, Dan has been a pioneer in many, many fields over the years with many accomplishments, including a very early pioneer in multiprocessor systems, and CM Star being one of the very early ones that we worked on together at CMU. He's been a pioneer in dependability and fault-tolerant computing. He's been a pioneer in mobile computing systems. He's been a pioneer in wearable computing. And I think this morning we'll see a little bit of a number of those fields. He's also a very prolific author of something like 500 papers and 9 textbooks. So how did he get time to come here? I know. Formerly, he was department head of the Human-Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon University, one of the departments in the College of Computer Science. And he's now head of the National Science Foundation Quality of Life Technology Engineering Research Center. And today he's going to talk about some of his activities that cross a number of those areas. So, Dan.
Thank you, Howard. It's a pleasure for me to be here this morning and see a familiar faces. It's been a while since I've been to the foundation. It's been a pleasure. And what I'd like to do this morning is take a little bit of time to tell you about some of the projects we have in the College Life Technology Center, particularly ones with a thrust I lead up called Virtual Coaches. And here we've got a couple examples of our project, First Person Vision, is one for perceptual awareness. You have a TV camera, and here you can see what the camera sees and recognizing objects, so people have a harder seeing, or if they don't remember what they should be looking for, we can provide them advice. PERMA is actually a personal mobility device attached to power wheelchair. It turns out that one of the major reasons that people with power wheelchairs get into emergency rooms is falling out of the power wheelchair. So it's kind of hard to pick things up. The robotic arms assist with that. Personal valet, get out of your car and just help find a parking place. That's something we all could like. In the old days, in the old Western, you'd whistle and the horse would come, and you whistle and the car comes back to you. And then this is a speeding coach, in particular here, warning the person who is going up a ramp. It's tilted back that the center of gravity is now in jeopardy. But it turns out there's other things that can be set. We'll talk more about this as the clinician explaining it to a patient. So anyway, these are some of the projects. As you can see, they're hands-on, and we particularly try to get them out to the user population to evaluate. So I'm going to talk about virtual coaches in healthcare. But before I do that, let me motivate it a little bit. We're all getting older, and as people age, their disabilities go up. And matter of fact, by 2030, one of every two working adults will be an informal caregiver. And this has a couple of implications. It turns out because people are caring for other people, their health suffers. So now we've got two people that need help. And there's a tremendous amount of financial going into this. Like, for example, if we could delay by 1 month a person going into a nursing home, that's over $1 billion a year. And people like to live independently, and if we keep them living independently, we have that financial improvement. And nursing home costs are going up by 10% per year. but 65% of people with disability are unemployed. The people that need that help are the ones that can least afford it. And then over 40 million informal caregivers provide about $300 billion a year in informal services to their friends and relatives. So there's some of the economic incentives for it. And what I'm going to be doing is talking about going out to the user population, finding out what are some of the design parameters that we need for the systems. In particular, you'll see that people prefer sensors like accelerometers over videos. So if we can do things with accelerometers instead of videos, that's not surprising, but we'll see how much surprising it is. And then it gives us some design parameters about how intrusive and how much time would the technology take before people would not want to use it. Then I'm going to go into some components of virtual coaches. Matter of fact, there's sensing, perception, user interaction, user engagement. I'm going to focus on just one in terms of the engineering challenges of resource management, both in power and user time, user interaction. And then I'm going to give you some examples of virtual coaches, one for each of the major components, and then look at the future. So that's where we're going to be going here. And so first of all, let me just talk about the Quality of Life Technology Research Center. We're entering our seventh year. I'm director. My co-director is Rory Cooper, who is in the Department of Rehabilitation Sciences and Technology at the University of Pittsburgh. Rory is actually a paralegic, Paralympic gold medal winner, and he's in a wheelchair, and he actually consumes the technologies that people in his lab utilize. So anyway, we're looking for intelligent, adaptive systems that enable older adults, people with disabilities, to live independently longer, as well as improve the quality of life for everybody. So idea here is to improve the employability and productivity across the lifespan of people, expand the range of environments in which people can operate safely and independently longer, and increase their community participation so they're not shut in, so isolated, so to keep that social component going, and increase the number of years that people can independently live in their home. That's the environment that they prefer being in, and also to help the caregivers who, as we saw, are also at risk in terms of health decay. So it turns out we know about human physiology, physical cognitive functions, and we're based on those technologies when designing intelligent systems. And then we want to create those systems that have a measurable impact on the population. And in order to do that, we have members of that population working with us right from the beginning in our design. And then, of course, we want to develop the curriculum and the students to understand this new technology. And so it's intelligent systems that augment body and mind. Now, if we have to do all those people sort of familiar with ARPA charts, sort of the center in one chart is here, we have four basic research thrusts. And we have four systems for us that try to take the technology from the research for us and integrate them into systems that we can deploy. Now, we saw a little bit about mobility and manipulation in that video, being able to reach down and pick up things. Perception and awareness, that first-person vision, recognizing faces, recognizing objects, recognizing people's intent, and we also use sensors. Person in society. This is important. It turns out that if people reject the technology right from the beginning, it doesn't matter how good the technology is. And so you want to find out what people are willing to accept so that gets the boundaries of how you design your system. Furthermore, if the government and insurance companies aren't going to pay for it, the technology won't go very far. So the person in society is how does the technology fit in with people and with society. And then human-system interaction. If the system are foreign to people, if they're afraid of them, you know, what does it make to have people connect personally with the technology so I can continue to use the technology and the technology becomes more of an assistant and a trusted associate as opposed to something to fear? And so we put this into a system in the home and the community. We'll talk about a health kiosk later, which is a community-based system for allowing people to take medical measurements and save themselves trips to doctors, but still allows doctors to interact with the people in a remote setting. Things in a home, so we can keep track of activities of daily living, find out if there's some long-term cognitive or motor decay that we can intervene with. QualPods, these are, well, we have two. One is our wheelchair with the robotic assistant arm. Another is HERB, which is a butler that allows you things to help people prepare meals and do other things in the home so that when my dexterity or my mobility is lacking, I can have some help. But one way we feel independent is being able to drive, move from one place to another in a mobile society, and keep people driving safely longer. Just a very simple example of that. As we go older, our ability to judge oncoming traffic speed, particularly in the dark, is compromised. And if it turns out my navigation system realizes my hesitancy, it could just tell me to only go around the corner or only go where I have left turn arrows. So very simple affordance there that would help improve my confidence in my driving. And then virtual coaches, which we'll talk about today, companions that sense what you're trying to do. And so I've got what I want to do, I have my capability, and I have what it takes to do the task I want to do. The difference between my ability and what it takes to do the task could be bridged by technology. And that's what the virtual coach is trying to do. We get these things out into individual, community, society settings. We have industrial partners, and of course, we have education and outreach. So one very exciting example of getting it out in the community, we're collaborating with a nonprofit organization called Blue Roof, which makes cottages that literally have about 100 sensors. So they can tell if your stove is on, they can tell if your front door is open, they can tell if you're in bed, they can tell what pillbox has been open. And they also do it for returning veterans that may have physical disabilities. They can actually get a 400-square-foot module with all these sensors attached to an existing house for about $50,000. And by the way, cost of power wheelchair is $40,000 to $50,000. For the cost of a power wheelchair, you can put the person into a home environment, and they don't have to renovate the home. And the person has a power key bar, and they've got upper body strength. They can get into the bathroom. They can get into the dressing room. They can get into the existing home. And so there are actually people living in cottages in the Keysport area where we're collecting the data that we can now analyze. And we were talking about big data before, so now we got lots of data from all these sensors. And then they have a focus group. I just want to give you one little example. They have a focus group that meets every Thursday. So we go take technology to that focus group and ask them about it. So one of the questions that came up was, well, do you mind if we sense when you're in bed? This 82-year-old lady raised her hand and says, can you tell how many people are in bed? No. Okay. So anyway, these are the type of things that that you get when you start working with the end user. So let me just give you the thing that got us started. This is about 7 or 8 years ago now. These were what I'll call first-generation virtual coaches. Often we used sensors. This was designed by students with accelerometers, light sound, temperature sensors, and one key indicator to us, one thing that we noticed was if we're doing exercises, this is the Body Media Armband, which is a commercial company that actually spun out of our lab early in the late 90s. If we put it on part of the body that's active, we can actually see the repetitions, and we can see when a person's struggling. Likewise, with cardiovascular, we can set upper and lower bounds for your heartbeat, and it plays music. And the tempo of the music speeds up if you want to speed up. If you're going too fast, it'll slow down. So I don't have to look at a watch or anything. Just a simple affordance like that. And we want to go through a particular rhythm. That's sort of a very interesting aspect. This is a manual wheelchair propulsion coach. It turns out we're trying to monitor the way a person's pushing a wheelchair. Right now, the alternative is a special steel and power wheelchair that costs about $2,000. So can we do that with something as simple as the wristwatch? So anyway, with that as background, let's go in, see what this person in society thrust does and what types of things they can do. So here's a national survey we did about privacy attitudes, and these are members at Person Society Trust that did this study. And the idea here is that privacy may affect public acceptance of monitoring technology. It could depend on what you're monitoring, the vital signs, moving around the home, taking medication, my cognitive ability, driving, toileting. Who gets that data? Do you get to use it? Does your family get to use it? Do your caregivers, doctors, researchers, insurance companies, government? And then how is that data collected? Is it collected with video, video and audio, sensors other than video sensors? And here are some of the findings. So here's the case. Who gets the information? Here's the different types of information we just talked about. And what you see is certainly people are willing to see it themselves, share it with their caregivers and their doctors, maybe researchers, but not insurance, definitely not government. Now, that's not surprising, but people are worried that their insurance will be affected if people see the data. They're worried that maybe their government benefits might be affected. So anyway, depending on the context and who gets it, people's acceptance varies. So the next thing is, well, what about the type of sensors? What if I have full video and sound? Video without sound, other sensors. What you see here, people are very wary of video, particularly toileting, but other sensors, they're fine. Matter of fact, a colleague of ours has discovered that you can find out a lot of things by just putting microphones on water pipes in the basement. If you ask a person, can I put the microphones in your basement, you know, be down there with the spiders and people probably won't even recall that they're there. But I can tell a lot of things. The water coming down, the water going up, is it the bathroom, is it the kitchen? And you can get a pretty good idea of the rhythm of the day by something as simple as that. So once you understand what you're trying to get at, sometimes the engineering technologies can be pretty robust and straightforward and inexpensive. So let's talk about some other things. Okay, well, what about the type of, where do we do sensing? And particularly we ask people, will you accept this if it prevents you from going to a nursing home? If the decision is I can live in my home or I have to go to a nursing home, that's a big threshold. And people's acceptance, as you can see, goes way up. But again, they're really leery on the insurance company. So anyway, so studies like this give the engineers some design parameters. In particular, they're less acceptive of video monitoring, especially in the bedroom and the bathroom, than sensors. And sharing information with insurance companies and government is they're not as interested in if it, even if it prevents loss of independence. They don't like to have their social interaction limited by the technology. They don't want to look weird. They don't want to be singled out. And they don't want to spend a lot of time learning the technology. So in particular, the tipping point. Now, in other words, if it takes more than 30% longer to do than if I had a human attendant, they're not interested. So they're willing to spend 30% longer, even more than what a human assistant would be. Now, in terms of maintenance of what I do, is I'll take an hour a day to care and feed the system. After that, my acceptance drops. And then there's these results provide these design parameters, as I say, when we're designing systems and we're testing them out. Okay, so anyway, that's the acceptance of the technology, and now let's take a look at one aspect of systems, and in particular, resource management. And there's two types of resources we look at, energy or power. How long can my system work on a battery charge? And secondly, the user. We saw that if things take longer, people aren't interested in necessarily using it. And often we forget that the user is a part of the system, and they're a resource, too, that needs to be managed. So it's a trade-off between the system and the user. these are the five components we'll be talking about. Prescription. How does somebody, caregiver, tell the coach what should be monitored and what's acceptable behavior? What is the census that senses the different activities? And tell the coach what's going on. How does the user interact with it? How does the coach make decisions? And then how do we keep the user engaged? You know, we want to keep them interested. We don't want to have them bored because they'll quickly abandon the technology. So we're going to go and just look at one aspect of this, which is the resource management. And the coaching model, there's two basic coaching models. One is rule-based. You write a rule. If this happens, like that power wheelchair that we saw, if I'm tilted back more than a certain number of degrees and I'm going up a slope of a certain number of degrees, tell the person, you know, they want to lean forward. And so that's a simple rule-based thing. And then one that's gathered much momentum is unsupervised machine learning, where we look at statistical models of the data. So we want to continuously monitor the sensors, and then we have to look for statistical patterns that mimic similar situations without human involvement in terms of labeling, and then we want to cluster these things into interactions and what the people should do with those interactions. And you can do something as simple as this. This is about 6 years old. This is actually done in a Capstone Engineering Design course. This is just a wristwatch which has temperatures, accelerometers, light, and sound, and it fits into a wristwatch form factor. And what happens when you're doing machine learning, you get these curves. They're continuous curves, like maybe acceleration. You take a 2 second window for that, and now I can treat that statistically. Area under the curve, number of times the curve crosses zero, absolute value, and other things. And if you can pick the right statistical parameters, here's just three of them that are looking at, can I tell if the person's running, walking, standing, sitting, descending, or ascending stairs? And what you can see here is that at least for these three parameters, there's the clustering of space. Now, I can easily draw planes and say, if I'm above here, then I'm doing this, if I'm up here. So that's basically 30 seconds of machine learning background. But that's what we're trying to do, is to find out where those separation points are and which parameters of those curves lead to maximal separation. Well, so what we want to do is to save power on these devices. It turns out that watch actually is only a 30 megahertz processor, very small embedded processor, very frugal as it is, but people want to go ideally a minimum of a 24-hour day without recharging. Think of your cell phone. You know, but you'd rather recharge it once a week or, maybe even once a month. So you don't want to have care and feeding of another device interrupting your daily activity. Your cell phone is enough. So anyway, there's power for the sensors in analog to digital converters, power for the computation to calculate those aspects of the curve and do the classification. And it turns out that there's sort of inertia in human behavior. You've been sitting here a half hour. Do I need a sensor waking up 10 times a second saying, are you sitting, are you sitting, are you sitting, are you sitting? I could put it to sleep and maybe ask every 5 minutes. And so there's ways of saving energy that way. And so what you need now is to broaden your definition of your performance metrics. So accuracy, did I get the classification right? Missed activities. Okay, maybe I wake up every 5 minutes, but you went to the bathroom, and I missed that activity. Or latency. You did get up and go to the bathroom, but I knew this 20 seconds after you did it. And so these are sort of new metrics. And now with these, I can see how my system performs. So one of the things that you get into systems like this is they typically sample 20 to 30 times a second. These are accelerometers. And everybody says that's accepted rate. Well, how do we know? So for those activities of running, sitting, standing, going up and down stairs that we talked about, what we did is we plotted the accuracy by as a function of the sampling frequency. And we get a mean here at about 6 hertz. So it turns out we don't have to sample up here. We can sample down here and still get what we want. So now I get a factor of 3 or 4 power savings because I'm 1/3 to 1/4 computation. The other thing is, do I do the computation in a frequency very expensive, or because I got to do time to frequency transformation, or do I just do it in the time domain? Well, this is a lot cheaper to do. We don't lose a whole lot. So we're going to do that. So if we do this, it turns out that if I'm sampling at 20 hertz, my battery life for that wristwatch is 9 hours. If I sample down here at 6 hertz, I double that. So I got that gain to go. But the next thing is, do I really need all those samples? Like I said, you're sitting here for quite a while. So what happens if I sample at less of a rate? So I'm getting a knee here at about 10%. In other words, if I only use 1/10 the samples that are possibly there, in other words, less sleep 9 out of 10 times, then what we'll see here is my classification accuracy is still in the high 90s, even for a variety of sampling approaches. My missed activity is down around 10%. Again, using only 10% of samples, so I missed you going to the bathroom with one of the activities. But my latency is less than 30 seconds. So many of the applications, the fact that if I have a 30-second delay knowing that you're going to eat lunch, probably doesn't make that much difference. There are other activities, if you try to play ping pong, it's devastating. But so depending on what you're trying to do, so by doing both these things, I actually increased my battery life by a factor of 10. And so now I can go, instead of 9 hours, I can go 3 or 4 days. So anyway, that's sort of just the conclusion of what we did. We can do lower sampling rates. So we can, even at the risk location, which is a lot of motion, I still receive that type of accuracy and get that through the increase in battery life. Okay, so that's interesting, but let's ask some other questions. Does it make a difference where my sensor is on my body? I was doing a wrist. And what we did is we basically put sensors on my wrist, in my pocket, in a book bag, a necklace, in my shirt pocket, and on my belt. Does it make a difference where I have my sensors? And here you see the accuracy and generally, no. So this is kind of interesting because these are places you might put your cell phone. And cell phones have sensors now. So I can be doing all this with my cell phone. Of course, you don't want to deplete the batteries so that people don't get to talk. So that's the other aspect. So just to show what it might look like, here is using those techniques with accelerometers. We have a student walk from their office to our commons area, sit down, eat lunch, go back to their office and resume their activity. And this is what it looks like in real time. In the classification, see, we're pretty good. Now, there's a little bit of confusion between running and walking and sitting, but I'm eating. And some of the actions I'm doing while I'm eating sort of mimic some of those actions I might do while I'm walking or running. So even though there's some confusion here, we can even infer other things beyond what the system is trained for. Well, that's kind of cool, but what about some other things? Well, surprising enough, I told you we had a light and sound sensor. Well, can we get fingerprints of rooms and know what room you're in? Like, for example, old-style TVs have 60 hertz component. Incandescent light bulbs are flat, no frequency component. And the answer is, same process, yeah. Here's the student's apartment. Riding a bus, their lab, their office, their restaurant, being down the street, even supermarket, same type of cluster. We can now classify where you've been. And most people, unless you're traveling, you're probably in a dozen places or less a day. So now I don't need any fancy location sensing system. I can just, you know, use the sensors on my watch, and there's no also I'm okay with accepting it. Okay, so all right, we talked about one sensor. Well, what about multiple sensors? Well, here's something that we're doing for FedEx, which does delivery of packages. And the idea here is sort of what we call ErgoBuddy. helping people ergonomically to correct lifting of packages. On-the-job injuries are very expensive, and so can we follow the type of business doing and then give them instructions about doing correctly? So here we extended the things we were doing before, things like loading boxes, scanning documents, carrying a box, moving a cart, climbing a ladder, and so forth. And they tend to have a handheld device, which is the green, that may be on their hip or maybe in their hand. But since they're wearing uniforms, we can also request them wearing sensors in other positions. And what you can see here is an accuracy of classification. So here's handheld, here is in a holster, and here is on the arm. And we get pretty much all we want with those three sensors. I've got a handheld device either in my hand or on my on the belt, and then I have it on the arm. I'll have a pretty good idea of what a person's doing. So we can actually do that with multiple sensors. Those are all accelerometers. If we move ourselves to it's accelerometers, but then we can look at galvanic skin response and heat flux. And you can see these things vary. These are sort of exercise activities like stationary bike, weightlifting, and so forth. And by adding other types, we can also increase our classification. So the basic research is saying, you know, what type of sensors, what are they good for, how much do we need to sample with them, what type of accuracy do we need to be able to have the system respond in an acceptable manner. But multiple sensors create another issue. What's the architecture? So here we have sensing the data from the sensor directly. We have to calculate the features, number of zero crossings, area under the curve. Then we have to do some type of recognizing the context and then the activity they're doing and then make a final decision. Now, one option here is to have individual sensors do more of the processing and have function less, or we could send all the raw data straight to a supervisor. So if I take a look at that stack of things, the raw sensor, extracting features, classifying, making a decision, different types of architecture. I can send all the data to a central source. I can basically extract the features, only send the features. I could basically make the classification that I think you're running, another sensor might think you're eating, and then that goes to a master device. And so here's using different sensors and so forth. The problem with collecting all the data and sending it to a central location is that things are very brittle. If I lose the sensor, then the whole classification is lost. And actually, with wireless things, we often see a 10 to 20% loss of data packets. Well, this distributed thing is much more robust. As a matter of fact, if we take a look at it, the centralized sensor is this here, and if we got 20% loss, I can do with two sensors. If I got 10% loss, I can do with three sensors. So with three sensors now, I can tolerate data loss and do better, do as well as, or better than something that had all the data all the time. As a matter of fact, in the worst case where there's no loss, this distributed thing is only 2% worse than a centralized system. So it's a good trade-off to distribute things. So if my batteries die in the sensor, it doesn't matter. I can continue working. So anyway, these are some of the type of engineering questions about power when you take into account the activity and what the person's trying to do. But one thing we haven't done is talk about what does this do to the user? And how much time does the user take? And so here's the case where we're actually predicting not only the power consumption, but also the user time consumption. And doing this at design time, not later on. And matter of fact, user interaction is, you know, when I'm interacting with graffiti or something like that, the system has to be paying attention all the time. And so lots of computation when I'm interacting. So here we're going to take, there's been something called P-scope level model, KLM, for just the user performance. But if we add energy to it, we can predict energy. And the idea here is that it's based on some very early work that Sue Carr, Tom Moran, and Alan Newell did, basically with a mouse and a keypad, where they define some physical operators like a keystroke, pointing with the mouse, coming back to home base, drawing, some mental operators, and then system response. So they created some heuristic rules, injecting mental preparation, because now I've got to take the time it takes me to perceive, time to think of what I want to do, time to move, as well as the computation that the computers do. And you sum up over all these operations over the whole benchmark, and you get a prediction. And so how good is that prediction? Well, it turns out that Bonnie John's got something called Cog Tool. Now, if I just have sketches in my interface, I can go from one sketch to another. Like, I slide down here, I get to this screen. I go over here, press a button, I get to this screen. And by going through that, you get some prediction. So his prediction, and then these are different types of interactions with touch screens and keypads and audio and gestures, and being able to take a look at running it with actual user experiments, people in the field, and you know the error 9% confidence intervals. And what you can see is, on average, at design time, I can get to about 10% of the actual, if I actually built it, did a user study, and analyzed the statistics. And so that's a tremendous thing that now we can do that while we're still designing. But the other thing that's kind of interesting here is that we thought that with hands off, it'd be much more efficient. We actually did this study with bus drivers and people in restaurants and so forth. And rather than pull something out and work on it in two hands, we thought, well, if I had a gesture here, if I just use gesture. Well, it turns out it's just twice as long. And as the other question, you know, in hindsight, we sort of figured out gesture recognition is not very good, about 80% accurate. So what you have to do is you have to do a gesture, and it says, did you say this? And then you have to do a confirmation. So I took two steps instead of one. Duh. But we didn't figure this out until we actually took a look at it to do the models. So it may be counterintuitive, some of the results that you get in terms of user interaction. And something like this could help you do that. So what? So that's what we did here down on this left-hand side. But now if I take some energy benchmarks to associate some energy with each of those parameters, I could then do energy prediction. And so, for example, we did this with PDAs. So here's a very simple, busy, idle state. You can see the power consumption is quite different between the states. And then by assigning these different parameters to different states, we could estimate the power. And how did that do? Well, we did a number of lookup tasks using different types of approaches. And here is time predicted versus actual. Again, we see we're less than 10%. But increase, other things that's important about it is, from an energy point of view, we're also getting less than 10% error. And again, we do this right at design time. We don't have to build anything. And one of the interesting things about it, if you remember, for a while there, that thumb wheel was very popular. And it turns out it's three times more power consumption. Well, why? Every time I move that wheel, I got a different image. Now, that image has to be designed, has to be rendered, has to be computed and rendered. Whereas if I touch a button, then I go to the next screen. So I'm only rendering one screen instead of incrementally all the screens. But, you know, the people who designed those things never thought about the, from a user point of view, never thought about what the energy consumption was. So now I can balance my resources, both energy and human resources, at design time. Okay, so how do we take all these things and put them into virtual coaches? So I'm going to give you an example of virtual coaches, and again, with each of the four components that we talked. So this is based on experience with, now we've got over a dozen virtual coaches that have different functions that they try to do, and they have different ways of addressing these five components. I'm just sort of putting this up here so that you realize that we've actually built quite a few. And the process is kind of interesting because there's a pipeline. We basically design the system, in particular with users involved. We call it user-centered design. Then if it looks like it's interesting, and often this is done in capstone design classes in engineering departments in multiple disciplines. And then we take other single-discipline design classes, like we have software engineering, make the software more robust, look like it's crashed. We have human-computer interaction, improve the user interface, and so forth. So they make that a more resilient, reliable prototype. And if that works, then we take it to the laboratory, and then we bring users in. We bring clinicians in, we bring in end users in, and let them try it and improve things, and then we actually put it out in the field. So there's a pipeline. You see we've made progress over the last 5 or 6 years with that. So let's take a look at, you know, we talked about accelerometers. I talked about putting something on the wrist. And it turns out when you're manually propelled in a wheelchair, instead of using this part of the body, the lower part of the body for motion, using another part of the body, it was never intended to carry, you know, large loads. And they're very susceptible to the wrist and rotator cuff shoulder problems. So there are. This is the preferred stroking. It puts the least stress on the biomechanics of the arm. Then there's some more flourishing things, and there's this little stroking thing. And so what we want to do is recognize this and then encourage people to do this. Well, what we did as an experiment is have the watch on hand, but we also wanted to have an idea of what type of terrain a wheelchair was going over. So if I'm on gravel or something, maybe the only way I can make progress is a short approach. And at that time, you don't want to tell people, use this, or if they're going up a hill, because then they'll go backwards and they'll stop paying attention. So, yes, we can do a very good job on that. Turns out the arcing one, which is this guy, this is the beginning of holding the rim, and the end. This is a subset of all of them, so that's one of the reasons. Its recognition was a little bit lower. And can we do it over different types of material? And the answer is yes. But it turns out the higher the resistance, more likely we're able to recognize what the material is. And so the thing is, it's one of these things where we're sampling. We don't need to, every second, be able to tell what material the person's looking at. We can do that over a longer period of time because we're not going to give people feedback that often, because we don't want to appear like we're nagging. Okay, so let's go now to prescription. So this was the power wheelchair where we added sensors to it. You can see that if I'm in this position and going uphill, it's kind of precarious. This is the type of position they want to do for relief of the pressure. And so we put sensors, tilt sensors, we put some IR sensors so we know how high the wheelchair is, if something's behind it. We also have some pressure sensors on the seat itself. And this is sort of an interesting thing. So this is what we're trying to avoid. When I have a spinal cord injury, I have no feeling in the lower part of my body. And if you don't shift your weight periodically, heat builds up, moisture builds up, and you get this. This is very hard to heal. Now, one of the things is it took us almost 6 months working with clinicians before we, what we were looking for was this. You know, what do you tell a person when they leave the clinic that they should do to relieve their pressure source? And, you know, we use the word prescription, which is probably a mistake on our part in the first place, because prescription to them was all the paperwork necessary to justify getting a wheelchair as opposed to instructions. Then what's surprising to us engineers, they had no process. Every person did something different. And so they actually started, because of our asking these questions over and over again, they finally got to a process. Now they're all doing the same thing. So now they can actually compare the results. So there are things like tilt. Okay, so I've got a wheelchair. I can recline, which is just in the back. Tilt is moving both the seat and the back. And that's preferred. So you can do things like, well, what's the ideal? What are the range? How long you should do it? How often between should you do it, and should I remind a person after a certain time if they haven't done it? And they just fill in the spreadsheet, and then from that, monitoring program gets compiled, and then the avatar comes back and coaches, so we experience with the avatar with people. So talk about independence of people is kind of interesting. So we work with DJ, who is actually in the office, but believe it or not, it takes 160 signatures to authorize a wheelchair. And so she runs around all the hospitals chasing the doctors, getting the signatures. So she goes through a set of tires on a wheelchair every 6 months, and you know, every 4 months has to have a new battery put in. But she was telling us one time she was going home, and it was flooding, and she couldn't get her van through the water, pulled out the power wheelchair, and drove it for a half mile through 14 inches of water, and it worked, and drip-dried it overnight, and no problem. So another time she had a friend that had a Volkswagen Beetle, flat tire, but no jack. So she pulled off her power wheelchair and elevated the legs and lifted the car. She's not telling the insurance company these things. But anyway, they want to be independent, and they've got a tremendous attitude. So let's take a look at something meant for community user and highlight user interaction. So this is what the students designed in the course that was motivated by some nurses that wanted to go out to your community high rises. And often, like my doctor says, you know, my every other doctor's visit just take my blood pressure. If I take my blood pressure myself, I give it to him, he's happy and saves me a visit. Well, if you're without a car, you have to rely on public transportation, they're late, you miss your appointment, and it's taken a whole day, you have to start all over again. Very, very frustrating. So here was physical measurements, the seat itself, the scale. I have grip strength, I have blood pressure, I have balance, and all was done with touchscreen because the nurses told us no keyboard, no mouse. And so this is what the students came up with, and let's see how we went through that stage of the pipeline. First system, then to make it more robust, we got software engineers looking at software crashing. We had students from the school design the furniture, and the idea here was to slide through drawers. So the scale itself was very heavy to move. So if I was in a wheelchair, I couldn't move that chair out of the way. The idea is you go around the back, the screen articulated, and we have a pull-through drawer so that you could pull it to the other side and have access to all. And of course, it took a little bit of cabinetry and stuff like that to figure out what to do with the table. The first step, and you start seeing the interface change. And then the aha when we went out to the community was we could put this chair on the side. And then I could either have a wheelchair here or a regular chair. And it wasn't as big an issue for someone to get up and sit on this as we thought it was. So this is where the user interaction comes along. And we have different views for the things. We have with the resident views in terms of surveys, physical tests, and history, what the clinician who services them is, and the administrator who has to tie clinicians to residents so that there's privacy in the data. So let me just show you the before and after. So this is as first designed by the engineering students, and after going through a lot of field tests, you see it looks different, it feels different. These are the type of things that you get when you go through these iterations. If people forget about the technology, how to use the technology, initially we thought a video would work, then we decided to put everything on a single screen. Well, it turned out to be a challenge and fun, so we ended up with one screen per step. So obvious things, but they came out from user studies. Here's another looking at trend data, and personalization became a big issue because one person's normal blood pressure reading may be high for another person. So how do we calibrate that? So the clinician can set what those goals are, and we just give people a color code as opposed to remembering numbers that they compare with their buddies. And so this brings up two example things. Blood pressure cuff, often put on upside down. And so put a little pill sensor in there so you can decide. People did things very literally. Like, first of all, touchscreen, they had no concept that any place on the touchscreen could be used for a font. So we have a chain, and you have no idea what next means. So you have to do things like press or press here. Okay, I'm pressing. Nothing's happening. System's broken. Not working. I'll never trust it. Every software engineer is taught to work for the release. Not that. You told me to do that. You didn't tell me to take off the blood pressure cuff. I left it on, but you didn't tell me. So simple things like that, no matter how great the technology is, if you do that, it not only does it break their trust in it, they talk to everybody else and say, don't trust that, the technology's no good. So these, again, simple things. And so let me wrap up here with user engagement. Give you an example here. This is a coach we have for people with particular balance problems. The idea here is you assess the patient, you give them an exercise. Presumably the patient goes home and practices those exercises and brings the results back. What we really get is this. We have no idea what they're doing. We don't know if they're doing it. We don't know if they're doing it correctly. And you rely on them. Do you do it? Oh, yeah. How many times a day? You told me twice. Yeah, twice. So the idea here is this is a simple exercise. You put a card on the wall, and you move your head, but keep your eyes fixed. The idea here is to push your balance in both your vestibular system and your brain to get into the place where you just start feeling dizzy and get them accommodated to that, keep stretching the horizon. So basically, it's an iPhone app. You put in a bill of a cap. We can take a look at, these are the two exercises. Did I do them with my rate of turn and so forth? And we can tell if they're complying, how well they're doing. And we just did a physical therapist, and they really love it. They can tell right away what's going wrong with the exercise, and they can advise the patient about how to do things. Well, exercises like this are boring. So how do we engage people further? Well, we've been working with a stroke rehabilitation. If I have a stroke, I've lost motor control of part of my body, and actually there's a company called Myomo which makes a brace that has sensors for contraction and relaxing, and it's got a motor, so you can give a power assist. So having a human do that, I can do that. Well, this is kind of boring. What can we do about it? Well, one of the motions, exercises, is a wiping motion. And so here's the case where we have initial marking, camera, and following the paddles, and we have a hang glider game, and where you position targets, you can now encourage the type of motion that you'd like to get. So can we combine that with it? And the other thing that comes out of this, we now we can start seeing fatigue factors, we can start seeing angle of motion differences and things like that. Clinicians have no insight, even when they're watching the person in the clinic, they have no insight about how this stuff changes over time. So let me map up two slides. If you get IEEE spectrum, in this month's spectrum coverage issue is I'm going to call generation smartphones, and there's an example of over a dozen applications from literally when somebody comes home where you put a sun infant death baby monitor on your application, you set it in the crib, vibrations, videos to watch the baby's breathing. One of my favorites, my daughter did this. We were at summer bed and breakfast. They had a pool, combination lock. She was about 2 years old, and we were hiding the number. Somehow she figured it out, opened it, got into there, and luckily our older daughter caught her when she fell into the water. But here, can I see what the person's, can coach see what's doing, and then call the parents, a ski instructor, meeting a friend that does basically American Sign Language, being able to translate that, strangers trying to approach you, face recognition, take a picture, where the neighborhood safe houses are, get some instructions, driving, work, reminding you to get up periodically, how to use crutches correctly, how do you train your son to hit a baseball, helping the elderly drivers, cognitive decline, health kiosks that we talked about. we're finally getting to a point of something that Howard worked on at one point, which is called the set of interviews. Now I can sense what my grandson is doing, and I'm grandpa, and I've already passed away, but I leave my tips to him on how to play baseball. Now he's passing through generations. So something as simple as that, we all see all kinds of apps coming. These can assist us throughout our life. So basically, to wrap up, our center has, in the Virtual Coaches, has set out a goal of activity recognition. You see that we've done a lot of that, identifying people's intent, and finally getting yourself an autonomic virtual coach. When the coach itself sees that your abilities have changed, it downloads an appropriate app to bridge that ability. And finally, the thing that makes us all interesting is we have all these other disciplines that we interact with. We got engineers doing IRBs, you know, in an institutional review board. We got undergraduate engineers doing IRBs. They now realize that a human is part of the system. So thank you for your attention, and if there's time for questions, we'll answer those.
Thank you. We will now begin the formal question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be announced prior to asking your question. To withdraw your question, please press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment.
Okay, those in the audience don't need to push any buttons. Jeremy?
Great talk, thank you. I was interested in the concept of the virtual coach and the at the beginning, you talked about acceptance in the 90% range, oftentimes the issues associated with keeping out of nursing homes. But I was wondering what sort of privacy issues you have and acceptance rates you have for some of these other things where there isn't quite as much obvious benefit to the person.
Let's see. So this was quite an extensive report, and I don't know if the answer that one answered the question. I'd have to go back and look at the report. But I don't have any data at the top of my head. In the report, I'd have to refer to that.
But the way that particular study was done, it was always a choice of alternatives. So you would get an acceptance rate, you know, but what if you had to have somebody living with you in your home, or what if you had to live in somebody else's home? The nursing home was the extreme case. You know, what if you had to have somebody bring you meals 3 times a day? So it was always it was a series of choice questions, you know, to determine the thresholds of whether something would be acceptable.
Yeah, hopefully there's enough information in that slide in terms of the authors. If you can't, send me an email, I'll get you a point of
view. Thank you very much for a very fascinating talk. And I have two questions. One is also on the acceptance. With regard to the driving, would my 89-year-old father-in-law accept the advice to go to the right, to the right, to the right, versus following the route we've been taking for the past year?
Well, that's an interesting question. I know my mother-in-law was having fading eyesight, and so she had picked a path that was not on the major thoroughfare, and most stop signs and things like that. Things that she knew she restricted herself to driving during the day. And so that's I think when people start losing confidence, and I don't know if we can develop a coach. You know, one of the things that they're looking at is pupil violation and other things that would be instrumental for the car. But if we can see that person's confidence is deteriorating, and we offer them other suggestions. I mean, there are people that just do not like to go over bridges, and that's a real challenge. And you can see some of the routes that they get, and say, I want to get from here to here, but no bridges, no tunnels.
The other one was there is so much new technology. The Google Glass, hearing, you know, gesture, of course, sign language is really perfecting. So I think that might definitely be helpful to what you're doing. But my question is about enols. Using sense of smell or some chemicals or whatever it is in the air, in the homes of the elderly people, because when you go to a home of another person, you probably notice the smell.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think it can be very indicative. There's spoiled food. There's mildew.
Yeah.
There's urine. There is sweet smell. They might be getting diabetes, etc.
Yeah.
And I think that there are now techniques that he knows that might be very effective in the home.
That's a really good point. We haven't explored that, but it's a really good point, particularly as we grow older, as I grow older. My wife's sense of smell is really good, but mine's gone.
Yeah.
So I probably wouldn't recognize these things.
Yes.
Having a sniffing dog, that's a good point. Something, we'll look at that. I think there's now getting
thanks very much for a terrific presentation. Would you be able to elaborate on the impact of this Engineering Research Center on your undergraduate curriculum or graduate education?
It's almost like it's been it's been gradually improved. Like I said, I'm really proud that we've got EE students doing IRBs. So there's sort of anecdotal evidence of that, and it's been very popular, not only with the students, but the people, students with disabilities. And we actually got, I think, first two people with, in a wheelchair going on to PhD because they've come up through the undergraduates and some of the other. So we have RU programs and things like that. There's a lot of places to do. I think it's a gradual change. Living it day to day is sort of hard. I have to step back into other metrics like the R&D. But it's, we've got students, more students than we can handle that want to work on. Because they see the impact of the system. And they see the need for it as opposed to something that's mathematical or further off. It also draws in people with disabilities and female students really like it.
Well, in fact, Dan has run a number of design classes in which they are focused on real problems, bringing people from a number of disciplines. As he mentioned, one was the bringing people from the School of Design, working with the engineers and the clinicians, and it's seen it's having these people learn how to solve real problems and do designs that reflect all of those constraints. That's been a wonderful undergraduate education experience.
So you talked about how there's very low acceptance rates when the data is going to be given to the insurance company. So I'm curious if you've done any studies around understanding if an insurance company is going to be paying for these technologies, do they have an expectation of getting some of this data?
I think the answer to that is, a work in progress. One of the two major insurers in the Pittsburgh area was actually having a retreat with the top people next week. They're particularly interested in home care and other things that keep their rates down. Keep the person out of the hospital, to keep people from repeating a return to the hospital. There's a good big economic incentive. So we're just starting to engage the insurance industry as partners, as opposed to, what's your attitude about this? Now we see technology allowing it to be distributed and keeping people healthier longer, keep them, therefore keeping their payouts stable.
Wonderful talk. And of course, there are a lot of issues that range from social issues to reimbursement and so on to accessibility. But I was in my lessons had a I was wondering whether you're thinking that if you can talk a little bit about the theoretical issues. There's a lot of theories that are behind the kind of empirical studies that you have presented. And I wonder if you think that there is a future for a field that would actually explore the relationship between biomechanics and the sound effects between cognitive systems.
That's a very, very good question. I think the pieces are starting to come together. For example, we have very large activity on campus using functional MRIs. and seeing what parts of the brain are engaged. As far as I know, they haven't done fMRIs for people with disabilities, particularly cognitive. But a very interesting thing is, not related to any of this, but Marshall Just does a lot of this work with machine learning with Tom Mitchell. And one of the things they've looked at is they're starting to see the architecture of the brain. Michelle's worked a lot with autistic children, and what they found is the white matter, sort of like the insulators between the front and back of the brain, autistic people tend to be less than others. But what they found out is with simple reading therapy, by reading to the person over a year or two, the white matter builds up, and the autism symptoms start to increase. So I think, you know, it's really fascinating that the fact that a behavioral action can change the chemistry and structure of the brain. You know, we have never thought that possible. But I think we're just on the verge of a really exciting time
huge advances in brain plasticity. You can actually look at the real life changes of the time.
So, Ms. Steinberg, again, thanks for the great talk. But my question actually plays a bit off of Pavel's question and a bit off of Martin's question. I can see the pipeline effects for students being drawn into the system, and I can see the science. My question is, the relationship such as interdisciplinary environments arise of new kinds of programs that are interdisciplinary?
Well, I guess the question, I mean, certainly we have these interdisciplinary courses. Now, whether there's enough material to make a whole curriculum out of it, as opposed to spreading it throughout the curriculum, I think at least initially it will be spread throughout the curriculum so that students will be exposed to particularly capstone design courses. But, we're getting to the point where a capstone design course, my capstone design course has several course numbers. So the capstone engineer can take it and get credit for their capstone. ECD can take it and get credit for their capstone. Design students in Fine Art College can take it and get credit. I think you're bringing the students together in these types of courses where they learn a lot from each other and learn to speak the language and learn the processes of others is the first step. And whether we get enough material other than capstone, of course, is really, really great because just extending the concept that you're an expert in your discipline, your sub area, and bring it to the course now to your discipline.
Hi, Dan. Richard Boyle. I have, if I'm understanding you correctly, on a lot of the data you presented on the acceptance was based on self-reported surveys, correct?
Yeah.
Yet you've had a lot of these various devices out in the field in before studies on this. How does that verify? Have you been able to verify some of those self-reported, which often questionable, whether these are actually come through with the real world?
Yeah, I think one of the issues here is the technology out broad enough that we could actually make an effect. In other words, a lot of these studies, the technology is not available to a large population at this point. Right now, these are studies for weeks or months at a time. When we get to the point where there's enough sensors on a cell phone and people have enough copies of cell phones, we do have something called ecological momentary assessment, which we're talking about, which psychologists use a lot instead of viruses. Keep the person periodically and answer some questions actually correlated to physiological responses like stress, soaring and obesity study, stress study, and smoking cessation study. And cell phone app, put it out there for a year as well. I think we're only starting to get to the point where there's enough of a population. Now, Google is only coming out with this killer app. Now, there's actually a small startup company called Vitaphone. And they're creating a little dongle that goes on your smartphone. And you have a sensor, and you can figure out the sensor. And a lot of the things that we have in the health kiosk, called what oxygen is. So now if I've got that on the software, it means that we made time or something like that, which is something that's available to the masses, and the masses is quite, then I think all of a sudden you can go across that device as well.
Okay, just one last question.
What kind of challenges are the verification foundation?
That's a very good question. What we're finding out, shared with Howard earlier, is that almost every one of these people is if something happened to them in a particular way or something, and, you know, they've been favored one way over another, and they've got this other secondary thing that comes in. And so I think you really need to be able to write that prescription or something like that. You really need to think about the mass volume with your project. And so we can get to that point, especially working with Howard Wilson, for each one, you need an ethical clinician that, you know, they're sitting in the chair and fitting the, doing the pressure mask, fitting the seat cushion and things like that. So that's the challenge. How do you get statistical validation that everybody can do? That's the challenge. Right now it's one battle at a time. Hopefully, as it's coming up in the bottom, we have enough data to start looking at this.
Okay, let's thank our speaker again.